Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a working film and TV editor. For the last 9 years, I've done nearly 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris FX products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today, we're talking with the editor of the TV series Star Trek Picard. Discussing season 3 is editor Drew Nichols, who is also an associate producer on the show. Drew started off in reality and documentary programming about 15 years ago and transitioned into scripted as an assistant editor on great shows like Mad Men and True Detective. He moved into the scripted television editor's chair on 12 Monkeys, The In-Between, American Cartel, and MacGyver. Before I hop into our discussion with Drew Nichols, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you're physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Drew Nichols on editing Star Trek Picard. Well, it's great having you, and I've been watching a bunch of Picard recently, and I was always a big fan of Star Trek The Next Generation. Back then, I was actually working at a TV station in Chicago as a promo editor, so I watched every single one of those episodes in detail.
You probably know them all better than I do at this point.
The interesting thing that I saw in your background, and I would love to chat about it if you're open to it, is you've come from a reality background, and there are so many people that are like, how do I get from reality to scripted? And so I know Chad Galster, who does all of the Taylor Sheridan stuff, has made that same jump, you know, into Yellowstone, and many people I've talked to have. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be editing Picard?
So when I first came out to Los Angeles, I was actually in a band. I played drums. Music is kind of a big thing for me. So while I was trying to do music, there was a reality TV house that was needing somewhat like a night AE to digitize tapes and to kind of do some very basic assembly editing stuff. So I started doing that, and that was overnight. I went to film school, but it wasn't until doing that where I started to be like, oh, there's something kind of interesting about editing, the rhythm of it, the construction of it, finding the story and putting the whole thing together. I had kind of taken on more tasks as that night assistant editor, and the people at the company, you know, I kind of saw that, and they're like, well, do you want to just, you know, switch into editing? So I said, absolutely, you know, sure. So I started, you know, editing reality TV, various things. The company I was at, luckily, they did a lot of interesting stuff. There's a lot of docudrama, you know, historical things. So it wasn't, you know, a lot of like the Kardashian side of, which is fine. But for me, I don't know how interesting that would have been after so long. So I had done that for a while. And then for years, I mean, it's probably 5-6 years I edited reality TV. And then at a certain point, I was just kind of, I was looking towards the future. And I was worried that I was going to get just burned out doing reality TV. It's a lot on yourself. You have to basically kind of be your own assistant editor. You're doing your own sound work. You're a lot of times finding the story in lots and lots of material, which is great practice. But at a certain point, you're kind of like, I'd want to go beyond this. I want to really have a great story and be able to refine that story. And through someone I worked, they were a sound editor. They worked on Mad Men. And so I'd kind of, at a certain point, I was like, hey, you know, you go in for sound spots on Mad Men. You meet all the editors. I said, you know, I'm curious about doing this. Would you mind asking them if they would just be willing to have lunch with me? You know, I'd take them out to lunch and just, you know, get their experience, see how they broke in, introduce myself to them. And so he was like, absolutely. So, I mean, all three editors of Mad Men, I sent them all the emails. They all got back to me. I had lunch with all of them. They were super gracious, super, you know, with their time and, you know, just being willing to meet with me. And one of the editors, Chris Gay, I met with him. He was like, well, he's like, you know, I have this kind of like this film that this independent film that I'm doing this summer. And he's like, it's there's no money. And he's like, I really, you know, I would love to have an assistant. He's like, I can do it myself, but I'd love to have an assistant editor. He's like, would you want to do it to just learn the ropes of, you know, scripted assistant editing? And I was like, absolutely. Yes. When do we start? So it was all at his house. So, you know, I drove down to Manhattan Beach to his house and I would, you know, assemble bins. He showed me kind of how he liked everything assembled. I would like bins laid out, the dailies process. It did sound work. He was kind of taking me through how he liked his tracks laid out and, you know, and sound ideas and stuff. He let me cut some scenes, gave me feedback. He let me sit in with the director who was at his house to see the whole process and also be like, okay, this is Drew's scene. You know, would you mind working with him? And I got to sit in the, you know, in the hot seat, as we call it, and get direct feedback from the director himself. So that was a super cool experience. And I was just thrilled to have it. So towards the end of that experience, he was like, so my assistant editor on Mad Men, he's got something else coming up. He's not going to be able to start this next season. Would you want to jump into Mad Men with me? And I was like, yeah, again, yeah. Where do I sign up? How, when does it start? Like, let's do this. Luckily, the post producer, Blake McCormick, was very cool about bringing me on. I had a independent feature. That was it. That's all the experience I had. He trusted Chris and I met with him. I interviewed with him. Apparently we had a very good interview because he was like, I'm going to give you a shot, basically. Like, let's see if you can do it. And it was very much being thrown in the deep end, but I relished it. And so I got to go and do basically the first season, you know, half season of the final season of Mad Men with Chris. And then his assistant editor came back. But one of the other editors, their assistant editor was going off to edit an independent feature herself. So that editor was like, well, do you want to just come on with me now? So I jumped from Chris Gay to Chris Figler and finished the final season of Mad Men. And then from there, that's when basically the floodgates were opened. From there, I worked on True Detective season 2, which was with Blake, who was the post producer who brought me in. And that's kind of how it all started. So, you know, it's funny how serendipitous it can be sometimes, but it's also about just being available and sometimes just taking a chance on things. When you start, maybe don't pay, maybe aren't, or low pay, but it's an opportunity to get some experience, you know, a credit, and you never know where those things may lead. That's how I actually, you know, got my start in, you know, from reality into the scripted side.
The couple of lessons that I take from that, or that I think people either could or should take from that, is one, people say, oh, it's a business of who you know, but it's not like it was your dad that gave you a job, right? It was, you had a friend that liked you, that you are a person that he thought, I will step out and people will like Drew. He's a good guy, right? So you need to have that going for you, I think. And also you have to work pretty hard. You know, you've got to, like you said, step into the deep end. You've got to be like, okay, this is over my pay grade maybe, but I'm willing to try it. Another thing that I heard that I really loved, a lot of times people think, oh, I don't have that skill set. But as you said, the first guy, the Mad Men editor that brought you on the indie, he thought he would like to work with you, you know, just as a person. Oh, I had lunch with this guy. He seems nice. And he was willing to teach you all the other stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And forever grateful to him. And he's the mentor still, basically. You know, I worked with him as a colleague, as an editor on 12 Monkeys. And I'll still text him and talk to him and, you know, ask him questions about things. And also from that, it's taught me how valuable that is. And so, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it on Star Trek Picard a little bit, but one of the other editors, Michael Benny Pierce, was an assistant editor on season two, and he got bumped up on season three. So I then kind of was in that role that Chris was in, where I was kind of just helping him along as a fresh editor, you know, here's how you do this, especially on a show as complicated as Picard, and make him feel as comfortable as he could, that he knows there's a safety net there, that I know this is the deep end, but you know, you're not there by yourself. You know, we're going to get through this together. And all those things I learned from Chris. And so I'm just kind of paying it forward, basically, which I think is great when editors can do that. And I think it's really special thing that editors can provide, especially to their assistant editors, you know, young editors.
And I've interviewed so many people that I am always amazed at how friendly and open this industry is to other people. Like, it's just over and over again, I see, hey, I want to help you out. There's very little that I hear of attitude from anybody at even the highest levels, to be honest. So it's great to hear.
Same. And some of the editors, very experienced editors that I've met who've been super cool and just down to, you know, just talk shop and just kind of answer questions. There's no ego. It's all about kind of everybody helping each other out. It's such a cool community, really. And I'm very fortunate that I get to be a part of it and trying my best to foster it towards, you know, the next generation that's coming in, you know, that's coming in after us.
And you mentioned that you're a drummer, and there are a lot of drummers in editing. Have you found that, or are you the only drummer that you know that's an editor?
No, you're totally right. It's you know, the amount of people that you're like, I play drums. Yeah, I play drums too. It's or music or something, you know, or I'm a guitarist or something. I think there's like rhythm and music, I think, are just essential to editing. And I think, you know, people who have that are drawn to that. I'm not saying you need to have that to edit, because you don't. I've met plenty of editors who love music, but aren't necessarily musically inclined themselves. But yeah, it's amazing the amount of people that you're like, you know, oh, you know, I like to play. Oh yeah, I'm playing a gig, you know, wherever. Okay, you play. Oh, no, that's cool. You know, and then you can talk a little music on the side of talking editing shop. So yeah, I think it's definitely a common thread for sure.
I also noticed that you are an associate producer on Picard, and I just got that title on the last TV series that I edited. How did you get it? Why did they give it to you? And what does it mean?
I had worked with Terry before in 12 Monkeys, where I got my start editing. I had come in as an assistant editor, and I got bumped up, and Terry was showrunning, and he basically gave me a shot on that. And so, you know, through doing that, I think I proved myself to him, and we did a couple of seasons of 12 Monkeys. I think he trusts me. And I think he also felt that there was a lot of stakes with season three of Star Trek Picard, because when you're bringing back this legacy cast, this telling this legacy story, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of fans who are going to be very sensitive about it, who are going to feel lots of different ways about it. So he just wanted to put his best foot forward and make sure that we were just doing it as well as we could, because of the scale of the production. And, you know, he was directing the last few episodes. He had asked me before the season, would you mind being on all the screenings with me, all producers' screenings with me, being kind of, if I can't be on a meeting, can you kind of jump in and be my voice if I can't be there? So in doing that, yeah, I kind of got this associate producer credit this season. And I was involved in all of the producer's cut screenings, you know, watching it all, giving notes. Sometimes he would ask me to pre-screen if he didn't have time. So it would just be me and the editor after the director's cut, just kind of basic stuff. We didn't go crazy with it, but just questions about certain things, about pacing, about, it was kind of, it's the first time for me too. So I think we were all just trying to figure out what the job entails in the end. But that was kind of, you know, I think the baseline for it was just, I think he trusted me to kind of be his voice in certain things where he just couldn't be involved in.
Yeah, I think that word trust, when it comes to getting those extra little titles, is big. That they feel like, oh my gosh, one, I kind of need this voice to help me. And two, I trust either their creative vision or I trust that they understand the process and the project enough that they can help.
Yeah. Yeah. And that trust was certainly forged on 12 Monkeys, where we had to do lots of editorial tricks and things to try to work our way out of jams sometimes. I mean, it's a time travel show and it was extremely well laid out. But you always get to those spots where something is suddenly like, oh, wait, that doesn't work now. How do we basically forge in fire and doing every kind of intercut, you know, pulling things from other episodes, flash forward, flashback things that we just kind of came up with that I think he felt like we could get out of any jam, basically.
Yeah, a problem solver.
Yeah, and you know, and I credit reality TV with a lot of that, about thinking on your feet and finding the thread in something that you wouldn't necessarily think the thread is there, but it is. It's just kind of hidden sometimes. So I credit that background with helping me to be kind of become a problem solver when, you know, when it's called on.
Yeah, I get that from a lot of reality, and I'm a documentary guy myself. And because you're used to not getting the story handed to you, you're like, oh, well, when the story kind of falls apart, I can put it back together again because I do it when there's no story.
Right. Right. Or when the note comes like, well, what else do we have? And you're like, well, lots of stuff. So let me go back in there and see.
Let's figure it out. Well, as I pointed out, I'm a big Star Trek fan, a Star Trek, you know, original. I'm old enough to have watched the original Star Trek TNG for sure. And one of the things I want to talk to you about as an editor is the need to deal with a lot of fantastical sci-fi dialogue, because I'm listening to this and I love it, but you're like, this isn't like a straight drama where you and I are talking about our wives or something and you can tell the truthfulness of it. They're like talking about aliens and humans and not humans. And you're like, how do you find the truth in some of that fantastic dialogue?
You have to lay it all out first, right? Just here it all is. And then you go through, and then it's like, what do we need? What do we need to tell the story here? And I think the cool thing with season three, specifically of Picard, is that Terry kind of, you know, he was doing it as this love letter to Star Trek, but I think he was trying to make it accessible to people who weren't necessarily giant Star Trek fans either. Like they recognized the Next Generation cast, like, oh, that's cool. And they could kind of just come into it. And that was fine. Like, you didn't need to see everything, every series, every movie. If you did, it was a benefit for you because there's Easter eggs planted all over the place and there's tons of stuff that you're going to pick up, but you wanted to keep it accessible. So, you know, there is a lot of great drama, like you're talking about, just basic drama. But then, you know, when you get to the techno babble, as we call it, you know, this things to explain the sci-fi things, we had to lay it all out. And then it was just passes of going through it and being like, what do we need? At what point are our eyes kind of glazing over a little bit? And then also, what are you cutting to with some of that stuff? We obviously have people talking, which is great, but what are we talking about? You know, is there a screen to show something? Is there a graphic we can create that will help? We can lose some of the dialogue, but the graphic will help to explain this thing, because it's important you understand what the thing is, because then we're going to go do the thing and you don't want to be confused while the action's happening. You want to have the table set, basically. So it was like passes of dialogue trimming and then those graphic explorations of like, what if we, it wasn't shot this way, but like, what if there's, you know, we're on a starship, there's screens everywhere. What if we pop to a screen and we create a graphic and the graphic does this? And that helps to explain and to get through some of this dialogue a little more efficiently and to keep the audience engaged so that they haven't turned the thing off before, like, you know, the action happens.
And having been able to work with some of the material, although I haven't edited the show, one of the things that I've been struck with is the importance of sound effects in selling the reality of it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, totally. Terry is big. He's a big Star Trek in general, all of it fan. So he would pull sound effects from original series, original movies, the next gen movies, and we would layer them in along with this kind of new soundscape that we had created, because, you know, the ship's new. It's not, for the most part, until we get to the Enterprise D, it's a new ship. So we want it to feel like a new thing, but also we want to have the sounds from the show that you remember. And like the one big one that he definitely liked was kind of the Sputnik sound that they used in the original series a lot on the bridge, that he wanted to like, well, let's pop that in where we can, just so it has that feel. Like, it just feels like Star Trek. It's just kind of a subtext. It's there. It's buried in the background sounds, but it's just a layer that kind of gives you a feeling. So he would have tons of that stuff. Like in the premiere episode of season 3, there's like the boatswain whistle, and that is pulled directly from, I think it was Star Trek 6, I think, The Undiscovered Country is where that is. The sound is, it's the sound. There's a couple spots where you have some beeps, and the beeps are from Wrath of Khan, and they are the beeps. So, you know, he brought specific things in along with, you know, our amazing sound team who just used a lot of these references, not only the specific things, but the references to kind of create this very elaborate soundscape. It's not overbearing, but it just makes you feel like you're on these ships. And it just has the essence of like Star Trek to it.
What elements are you working with when you've got purely CGI images, when you're early in the edit? Are you just putting up a slate? Do you have some pre-viz, some conceptual art? What are you using?
Big shout out to the VFX team, because some of these shots are like feature film level CG shots. So they take lots and lots of time to do. So basically what we get from the VFX team is that they would read the scripts, and then they would start doing some previous CGI type stuff as far as like ships and different things. And they would send that stuff over to us for the most part, for some of the bigger set piece stuff. And they would give us like a couple of different camera angles. They'd be like, you know, here's it from this side, and here's it from this side, and here's what, you know, and they would just kind of create stuff, and they would give it to us. And then that way we could have something to work with as we're piecing it together, and we could kind of play with what angles do we want to use. Is it better seeing the ship from the front, or is it better from the back? We were lucky that we had some of that stuff to play with. But other things is exactly like you said, it's a slate. It's just a slug that's like, here's what happens. And it's one of the things you learn with doing a lot of big VFX stuff is that you got to use your imagination. So even when I'm editing, you're just kind of like, okay, here we get to the thing. And I mean, if someone was recording me doing it, I'd probably look like a crazy person, because, you know, you're just like, you're talking through it, or like, you're making sounds.
I was going to say, you're making the sound effects, right? You're like, okay, that's the amount of,
exactly.
That's how long
you're using
I need
your
it.
Hands. Right, exactly. You know, it's torpedoes, you're firing, it's going to hit there, then I'm going to cut back into it. So you're just making it up for a lot of that. And then a lot of times we put sound effects into it, and then we'd send those slugs to VFX to be like, hey guys, here's the early thing of what we're thinking is going to happen. We've got some sound effects to kind of show you the timing of what we're thinking. But again, it's just a guideline. And then VFX would do their thing, and then we'd get something back. And then we had things to note and things to talk about. And Terry was very big into the VFX of it all, and just really wanted to get the ship stuff right, you know, because it's such a huge part of Star Trek. So luckily, yes, we did have some of those things to work with, but yeah, otherwise there's a lot of imagination happening in various stages of the process in the edit room.
Yeah, what can I use to show this thing? It's cool that you got some previs, and especially that there's different angles, that they didn't just stick you with, here's a spaceship.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was cool to see the VFX team have ideas and be invested creatively with it. Like, you know, it wasn't just us, like, we need this. It was like, the ship's going to do something, and here's the story, what's happening, go. You know, you guys go. And there was only a couple of specific times where we literally had meetings with the previs, like CG artist, where we were very specifically trying to get the idea. And the example I'll point out was in episode 4, where they're escaping from the nebula, it's exploding, right? The ship is riding this shockwave. So that was one of the things of like, well, how is the ship riding the shockwave? What does it look like? You know, at a certain point, it kind of, you know, things are going wrong. What does that look like? So we had a meeting with them. We're like, can we dial in the shots about what's happening? And then at the end of that, they throw an asteroid at the villain's ship, the Shrike. But you're like, where are the ships? Because, you know what I mean? It's like, we're flying out of the thing. The Shrike is here. So that was one where we had a big meeting, all the effects. And it was cool because we could go into, we were remoting into the previs artist station, and he could basically just like move everything. Like, okay, here we go. We're going to go over here. You want to go up this way? Okay, cool. So it's going to go like this. And then like, we want to do a reverse, and he would just swing it around. and we could just talk about where the ships are. And it was super efficient, rather than getting, here's a previz. Like, no, it's not right. You know, I'll go back to it. Here's another previz. No, it's not quite right. Where you're going back and forth and it's taking forever. Because again, these shots take so long to do, you don't have time to do that. So there was a few instances where we kind of used the technology in a cool way to bypass some of those early notes passes and kind of get to the root of the shot.
Were you in Evercast or just a Zoom call or?
Yeah, it might have been Zoom on that one.
But you're right. It's very useful to, I know like with 3D, the guys can just move the camera. They can spin things around. They can go, let's make the two ships closer to each other.
Yeah, they'd be like, let's put a different lens on the camera. Right. You know what I mean? On the virtual camera. And then, that's cool.
But like, getting a delivered shot, that could take, 12 days to try to get the right combination. And you give a note and then the next thing's wrong and you give another note. And so you might as well just sit there with the guy. Were you doing that as an editor or as a producer?
So that one was, I guess it's hard on this because I'm producing as well, but that one was my episode. So I have a feeling Terry would have brought me into that, regardless with the VFX of it all. I always look at it as like my job in the VFX of it is to make sure we're telling the story, because VFX can get, oh, look, it's cool. The ship looks amazing. It's awesome. Like, wow, this looks incredible. But is it telling the story? Okay. Well, guys, hold on. We have a problem here because what we're trying to say is this. You know what I mean? Because a lot of times VFX doesn't get the whole thing. They're just getting the thing. So I think there's a little back and forth as far as like, what are we trying to say with the shot? And, and some shots are just A to B. We're traveling A to B. And some shots are, no, this is the story that's happening. So I mean, that's usually my job on the VFX side of things. But yeah, in this particular one, I think Terry was kind of bringing me in as a producer on it as well, to just be another voice, be someone that he could be like, is this crazy? Is it working? Like, or is it not working? Where I'm honest with him. So I would certainly tell him if it was not working.
Yeah, I think it's that honesty is something that comes up over and over again that is a valued asset of an editor, something the producer looks for. You're like, I hate when he tells me that something isn't working, but I'm glad somebody's doing it now instead of later.
Yeah. I mean, I always look at the edit room as kind of like a therapy session for everybody at some point, as far as like getting all the baggage from set off and all the things that happened, and let's erase all that. Let's get all of our systems. And now let's like focus on the thing. There's no benefit to not being honest about it. Now you have to be tactful about it and you have to find the time and place to do it. But I think there's absolutely need to be honest about it if it's not working. And you may not have the answer, but I think it's okay to put out there, is this working? Is this feeling right? And a lot of times those are the notes that you get to start with. I don't know if it's working yet. And there may not be a solution, but as long as we're all honest about what we're feeling about it, and if there's, if it's working as is, or if it needs some work. So I think honesty is the keystone to all of it, really.
I noticed in multiple episodes, just like it is almost in any TV show, that you've got a lot of jumps in time or storyline jumps from one person's story to another, or one planet to another. Is all of that stuff happening as scripted, or are you finding that you're needing to move some of those edit points between one scene and another, one storyline and another in post?
Right. Most of the time it is. Sometimes it'll just be as you're going through it, you're like, you know what? We've been away from the other people for quite a while now. Is there any benefit? And again, it's always a question. Is there any benefit from popping over to them? Is there a spot we can go over to them and catch up? And a lot of times when you start to do that is when you start to get the cool intercut things happening that you might not necessarily have thought of, but then you start doing it and you're like, oh, well now, this, and then we can go back to this. And then, you know what? We actually don't need the end of this scene because they're just setting up this thing, but now we're into that. So we can lose that. And now the pacing picks up and it's an exploration, like with all of it, as far as just watching it and getting a feel as far as like, who are we missing? And it's an added challenge with this season because there's so many characters. You have the whole Next Gen cast, and you have Rafi and Seven from previous seasons of Picard. And you have Todd, who's playing Captain Shaw, who's, new character. And so now you have all of these characters and you want to make sure everyone gets their time as well. So that's another factor. You know, have we been away from somebody for so long now that it's like, what have they been doing? Is it jarring when we come back to them? Oh, right. I had completely forgotten about this storyline. So yeah, a lot of it's laid out as it's scripted, but I think through doing it, we've kind of found new points to cross over and check in with the other team, you know, and kind of go back and forth. And that's something that you just have to kind of feel out as you're doing it.
And when you're cutting these scenes, obviously you're choosing a pace, you're choosing a rhythm of the cutting in the scene itself. And then how much is that of that is changing either contextually as you see the scenes together, or is there any time pressure? Do you need to hit times?
No, on this one, there was no overall episode length or anything. I think Paramount kind of wanted them to try to be under an hour if we could. But yeah, there wasn't that. I'm used to that on some network TV where, you know, got to get to 43:50. That's our time. And then you're trimming with the time in mind. This was nice because you weren't. You're just kind of trimming and cutting as the scene dictated. And for me, as soon as you make changes, it ripples through everything. Like, there's not just like, oh, replace one thing and then it's done. Like, no, the timing will tend to just change ever so slightly. And then you find yourself kind of retrimming and kind of going through scenes again, because they're almost like living organisms. They are constantly in flux. They're constantly changing. But I think that's part of the cool thing about editing in general, is that it's such a evolving thing that you're making. It's constantly changing. And so, yeah, luckily we didn't have the time pressure. It was so that we could really focus on what feels the best. You know what I mean? Does it need to slow down? Great. Let's slow it way down. And we did that in some spots too, where I think on a network show, your instinct would be like, we don't have time to slow it down too much. But on this, we kind of could. And I think that's evident in like the first episode, where a huge chunk of it is them getting on the ship and taking the ship out of space dock. And Terry really wanted it to feel like a moment. Like, this is the launching point of the season. You know, let's live with it. Let's be in it. Let's see the ship come out and let's really enjoy like the space, the exploration of it all as we begin our journey. And I don't think we could have done that if we didn't have the network time constraint. I think it would have been, well, what's the best way we could bop through it to, you know, get the story moving here. It allowed us to kind of take the time on that, which I think is cool. And I think that sequence is so quintessential Star Trek as far as exploration, space, the final frontier. Let's go on a journey. And that's what, like, that's what we were able to lean into with that.
Yeah, you mentioned the fans before, and that's just something fans want to see. You're like, as little story as that has, like, okay, as soon as they leave, you're like, if you're a trailer editor, you're like, I need 2 seconds of that shot. But if you're a fan, you're like, I want to watch that for an hour and a half.
Right. Yeah, we just left the ships on. Yeah, it was like, you know, this is like the full VFX previs. I don't think VFX ever imagined we'd use like the entire shot, but you are, because it looks so cool. And then our composer, Stephen Barton, just did phenomenal job with creating this new theme for the Titan that was so Star Trek, but you just wanted to like hear it. Like, you just wanted a moment to just listen to it and see the ship and just enjoy the moment of it all before it's going to get crazy and we're going to have plenty of action. But like, this is a moment to just enjoy the start of the story. So yeah, hopefully I think the fans really enjoyed the ship porn, as we call it, just letting the ships live on screen for a while.
You mentioned the composer. What were you using for temp during this? Were you trying to temp with all Star Trek stuff, or were you temping with like what any of us would temp with?
Yeah, I think there was a mixture of both. I mean, Terry really wanted to, he really wanted to get into some of the classic themes, the Goldsmith, the Horner stuff, but give it its own spin on it. So we had all of the Trek soundtracks to play with. And we use them a fair amount. And then there was just the things that we normally temp with, because when temping, you're just trying to get a bit of the rhythm and the emotion of it primarily. So, you know, temping with Star Trek stuff was hard because it's so scored. to the thing. Like half the time you listen to it, oh, right, that's the part where they do the thing in the movie.
And you're
like,
that's okay, where he pushes the button. That's where the guy gets his...
Right. That you're like, well, I can't. And it's hard to edit some of that stuff too in the temp side. So it was just more of your kind of normal temp score stuff that then Steven took, and then he just kind of Star Trek'd all of it in a great way. Steven and then Frederick Reedman, who's the other composer, came on. They both had a great ear for taking the blueprint and being like, okay, now we're going to make it the show.
You mentioned the showrunner did some directing of the final couple of episodes. What about before that? What is somebody that's been on the show, what kind of stewardship are you doing with a new director or with a director to try to make sure that they're delivering what the showrunner is eventually going to want?
I mean, I take this approach with all the directors in TV, and it's kind of a cool aspect of working in TV is that you get to work with so many different directors, see all their different processes, the things that they like, the things that they don't like. And the thing that I always try to bring to a director with when their director's cut is, we have the editor's cut. The editor's cut is everything. I put everything in. Every line is in, even the ones that are like, this is gotta get removed. It's all in there. We have the whole thing. Here it is. So now let's make our own thing. What do you like? Here's my pitch for things that I'm feeling like this is feeling clunky. What can we do with it? And so I just say, let's do our own thing. Let's cut whatever we want to cut out of it and rearrange whatever we want to rearrange, because the cut exists. We have the editor's cut. And if there's ever a question about what was cut, here it is. Here's what was cut. Here's why we cut that. And they may agree with it or they may not. But I think it's crucial to start the process going of finding the show. And so I try to be, again, supportive with directors and a safety net as far as like, look, let's do this and we'll take it as far as you're comfortable with. And if you're not comfortable rearranging whole chunks of it, that's totally fine. We won't do this. It's your cut. Like, what do you want to do? What lines do you want to lose? What temp ADR do you want to put in? Like, let's do it. And then the showrunner is either going to say yes or no to the things, but I've never had a showrunner who has a bad reaction to seeing a director's cut where things have been removed. It's always, what was there? What was the scene? Here's the scene. And then most of the time they're like, yeah, I see why you cut into that. Okay. The scene is going on for a while now. And maybe we don't do that, but maybe we do something else, you know, and that's just the process. So yeah, I just try to, the director's cut is their cut. And I want to be a collaborator with them and experiment with things. So as far as they want to take it in the director's cut, I'm down to do it. And if they're not, and they have hesitations, but they have caveats, I'm happy to pass those along to the showrunner as well. They were thinking about maybe doing this, but we're worried it was going to be too extreme, but it's a pitch, it's an idea. So it's a full collaboration on all fronts, especially in television, with the time deadlines and with the multiple episodes that are happening. So I just try to be as much of a team player and as supportive as I possibly can be, because I know it's a really tough job.
Well, you mentioned the editor's cut, the director's cut. Fill us in on what kind of schedule we're talking about. What's the shooting schedule? How long do you have to have an editor's cut ready for the director? And is it the typical 4 days for a director, DGA, or do you have more than that?
Yeah, so this one was block. We were doing block shooting, so two episodes at a time. So director would do two episodes. I believe it was like 20 days to film two episodes. They had about 10 days an episode. So they would shoot, you know, we were cutting while it was happening, obviously in communication as things were coming in, as far as like, hey, I think maybe, you know, you might want to pick up a shot of this because I don't think we have it necessarily. And sometimes the directors would do it. And sometimes they would be like, well, I wouldn't have time. We'll get it later. But just try to be, you know, again, as open as you can about the things you're discovering. And then, you know, I think it was like 3 days for the editor's cut, you know, after the shoot was done to get my editor's cut together. I have to give a huge shout out to my assistant editor, Justin Block, who is a sound master. And it's kind of the reason that you're able to get shows as complicated as this done in that amount of time, as fully formed as we can, you know, with temp score and sound effects and a lot of temp effects where we can. And so then, yeah, the director's got 4 days to work. And then it was off to producers. And I'm trying to remember if there was a set time. It might have been like 9 days or something for a producer's cut, but that was a lot of times flexible depending on other things that were going on. But I mean, fast paced for sure.
Yeah. Does it help on those crossboards that you're getting half the material, or?
You know, it actually does. I didn't realize. At first, I was like, I don't know how I feel about cross sheeting. But then in the end, it is, and it's actually a total lifesaver because, yeah, some days it's all your episode. So your dailies are huge, but that's what you're used to anyway. Like, that's what I'm just used to is getting a full episode's worth, and that's what my dailies are. But some days you'd get none. And then you're like, well, now I have a catch up day. And so I can go back to that scene, you know, that massive scene that was giving me problems before, but I just kind of stitched it together just to make sure it was there. Now I can go in and actually like look at it and re-look at the dailies again and just kind of make sure that I have it. So that was quite nice. And that you just have more time then. It's almost like you have like 4 weeks of shooting. I didn't feel as much pressure with the block shooting as far as the editor's cut goes than some other shows, even though this show is much more complicated with many more visual effects than a lot of other shows.
Any specific scenes or an episode that you remember some cool creative solutions that you came up with that needed to be done?
Let's see. On this one, I think episode 6, which is where they have to go to Daystrom Station and they're trying to get in to see the archives, to see what the changelings had taken from the station. So it's kind of like a heist type thing. Meanwhile, our crew are kind of, they're being pursued by Starfleet. So they have to kind of disguise themselves. So this is where we meet Geordi for the first time. They go to the Fleet Museum and they get to see all the cool old ships. So that episode was a challenge in a way because it's kind of a heist, but you want to keep the tension going the whole time. So they're on the station and you're intercutting between the two things. Again, the problem is if you're on one too long, then when you come back, it's almost like you need a reset. Like, where are they going or what's going on in this? And there was a couple of like bits of scenes that just, especially on the station side, felt like they were just, it was dragging the pace down and it was starting to lose the tension about what was going on. I was feeling like, well, how do they have so much time to stand around and chat? You know what I mean? Like that was what was starting to creep in the back of your mind, which like, that's not good. So yeah, we had started to like, oh, what if we intercut this bit or this bit? And there's a really cool kind of sequence in that one that's about legacy. It's after they find Data or what will become Data that was different scenes, but Terry had the idea of like, well, they're kind of talking about, it was Picard and Geordi talking about their children and the things they pass on. And then on Daystrom Station, it was about Sung, the hologram of Sung, talking about all the different personalities that he'd put into this data. And that hoping that all of these different things that he passed down would then come together and kind of create something better. So they were kind of talking about the same type of thing, but there were different scenes. So Terry was like, what if we just intercut this? Like it's a whole, like they're both talking about the same things and we'll pre-lap, post-lap dialogue over the two different scenes. So we had started doing it and then it was like, it was very cool, especially because they're at the Fleet Museum. So while you're talking about things you're passed down to your children, you're seeing all the classic old ships from Star Trek. You're seeing the Enterprise, Kirk's Enterprise. And then just going around, now you're seeing the Titan. So it just had this great, one of those great moments of like all the elements that were perfectly coalesced together to kind of create this really cool moment that had a lot of emotion and impact. And I think talking about them in individual scenes would have just whereas brought down the emotion of all of it. So that was like a cool problem solving thing where it was like, we have all these scenes. They're just going on and on and on. How can we make it feel like something? So that was a pitch that was like, roll up the sleeves and let's see what happens. We start slamming these things together. And I think it turned out pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard about that more and more where there's two scenes and maybe they're a little slow and you're trying to figure out, well, how do we pace it up? And well, you can't really because people move around the room or something and now they're in the wrong place, that kind of stuff. And you're like, ah, but what if we intercut the two scenes? That solves all our problems. And like you said, it also lends two concepts together, like the family.
Yeah, It does. And I think it magnifies the emotion, where the scenes themselves were, they were nice scenes, but together it had this other element to it that it just felt almost took your breath away a little bit, especially as you're seeing like the starships around the Fleet Museum, that beautiful shot that the effects did. We're seeing all these old ships and its sense of legacy and things we passed down. And it was very, very cool. I mean, temping that one was the hardest part of it, finding the right score to kind of thread you through it, but keep building with it as well. And then Steven just blew it out of the water when he scored it. It was like, this is amazing. And in the end, you're almost like, I couldn't see it any other way. You know what I mean? In a weird way, even though this came from an idea that at the end, you're like, this is kind of how it had to be.
Yeah. If the funny thing somebody once said to me was, because you're like, oh, well, why didn't it just start that way? Is somebody said, if I showed you what it was going to end look like at the end, at the beginning, you would tell me I was crazy.
Oh, I say this all the time. Yeah. If you could just let me screen you, let me take my time machine. I'm going to screen you the finished thing that we came up with. You could have so many notes on it. It's just, it's the process and where you are in the process. And sometimes it circles back. Like sometimes you go down the road and then you're like, you know what? I just think it was better the way it was before. And that's happened before too, where it's, you've tried, you really tried, you know, you took your big swing at it and you know, and you're just like, you know what? I think it was better. And sometimes you need the journey to feel right about it in the end. Like, I wasn't crazy. I think it's actually, this is the way it is. So it's all about the journey. And I think that is the cool thing about getting notes, about the collaboration of it, is just the exploration of the material, of the story, and seeing what works and what doesn't. Because a lot of times, if it's working or if it's not working, and sometimes it just takes going down the wrong path to realize, oh, this wasn't broken at all, actually. So it's all the process entirely. And I think that's the cool part about the edit, is the process. You know, it's not shooting. It's not just like, here's the footage, here's the angle. It's, what can we do with all of this? What are the various combinations doing? How is it helping or hurting? Or what are we finding from all of this? It's the thing that makes me most excited once the editor's cut is done, because that's the foundation, right? And that's everything. Now, let's see what this thing is. Let's pull the thing apart and rearrange it and see all the different pieces, look at the pieces. Do we need that piece? Then I get rid of that piece. You know, let's move this thing over here. It's such a cool, interesting process that makes you feel good at the end, because again, I think you'll realize, like, the edit's never done. We could edit these things forever. You could endlessly keep doing it. But at some point, you have to feel good enough about what you've done that you can just say, you know what? This is good. No, what we've done is, this is great. You know, you can always second guess everything, but it's the exploration of it that gets you to that point where you can just sign off on it, where you can say, no, this is, what we did is great. And, you know, I can't wait for people to watch it.
Something you said made me think of you as a drummer again. And it's not necessarily that you know rhythm because you're a drummer or pacing, but it's also that musicians are usually in bands, which means you're collaborating, which means you're going, oh, you know, do we have to do like 12 verses? Maybe this song would be better if there were only 3 verses, you know, or let's do the bridge here, or maybe this is a good place for a drum fill, whatever. You're in there going, how can we plus this? It's not just Paul McCartney going, it's my way or the highway. You're going like, hey, what do you think? Oh, I like that guitar thing. Let's do that guitar thing right here.
That's a perfect analogy, because it just brings me back to songwriting with my buddy who was in a band with. Was he would play something, like, that's cool, you know, and he'd play a couple of different things. You're like, that's cool, you know. What if we did, like, you know, pull that bit from this bit and then we did this thing here, then we start, you know, then you start to play it out, you start to jam on it, and then it's, you know, he's like, what if he did it this way? And then you're like, oh yeah, it's, you know, and think about it that way, like, well, that's cool. And it's that, yeah, it's that play back and forth of just pitching and just trying things.
And they fail, no, right? You're like, oh, maybe we should switch this to a different key. And you're like, oh, no, let's go back.
Yeah. Absolutely. But you have to try it is the thing, you know what I mean? Because otherwise you would always wonder if you never did try to switch the key, maybe it's amazing. Maybe suddenly it just takes it to a whole nother place. You're like, wow, I had no idea it was going to go there. And yeah, sometimes it just crashes and burns, but you don't know until you try it. And that's why I'm an advocate of always trying every note, all of it. Even the ones that you see and you're like, I know this is definitely not going to work, but I'm going to try it. Because again, the beauty of nonlinear editing, we have it. We can just go back and just revert. It's like, it's no big deal. I'm not sitting here all night on a flatbed making a bunch of stuff. And they're like, nah, I don't want to do any of that. And you're like, okay, well, now we got to revert all that. You have to try all of it. And in trying it, sometimes it doesn't work, but it gives you an idea for something else that may not even be in that episode, but might be later on. And you're like, you know what? I had this thing. I was doing notes on this other episode. And I kind of have this idea. I think it will work here. Can we try this? And that's what's cool about working with someone with Terry too, is that he's open to all of it. Like he's like, yeah, man, let's try it. Like, do your thing. Hey, you have an idea? Have at it. He's very hands-off with a lot of it as far as here's the concept. I trust you to play with it and see what I want to see what you come up with. It's a great amount of fun. And it was one of the real rewarding things this season in particular, you know, because you're doing that, but you're also doing it with like some of your childhood heroes, with these characters that, you know, I grew up with watching, that it was sometimes you had to pinch yourself. You're like, are these characters really on my screen right now? Like it's incredible.
Yeah, that's definitely the way I would feel about it. And so many other people probably would as well. I think we have covered a huge amount of really interesting material. I love the discussion of musicianship and how it preps you to be a good editor and all kinds of great conversation points that we had. So,
thanks.
Drew, thank you so much for being on Art of the Cut. And it was a pleasure learning about how you helped construct Picard.
Absolutely, Steve. Thank you so much for having me. This was amazing. Love your show. I'm honored to be able to be a small part of it. So thank you.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Drew Nichols for joining us on Art of the Cut. Thanks to Sam Rosenberg for editing today's podcast. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.